This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. And I want to begin this next conversation by reading from a piece that was recently published in The Hill newspaper. It says, when the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention relaxed its position on masking in May, that's last year, stating that vaccinated Americans no longer needed to mask or practice social distancing, the seven-day average of U.S. COVID deaths was 631. Today, as mask mandates are dropping in many American cities, counties, and states, the seven-day average is more than twice as high at 1,268. Far from a rational response to changing epidemiological metrics, the relaxation of COVID regulations appears to reflect a broad acceptance of mass mortality. End quote. Indeed, here in Illinois, an average of 19 people a day are still dying of COVID-19. That's as if a fully loaded passenger airplane crashed every 9 or 10 days. And it's about as much death as we were seeing at this time last year. Of course, we now have vaccines and boosters, and President Biden has said we're in a pandemic of the unvaccinated. Even so, nearly 4,000 fully vaccinated Illinoisans have died. To be sure, that's a tiny share of the overall vaccinated population, 0.48%, but it's still a lot of empty chairs at this Thanksgiving. As we end the third March of the pandemic, this idea that in order to live more normally, we have to move on as people continue dying among us, well, it doesn't sit right with everyone. Such is the case for our next guest, Richard C. Keller, who wrote that piece in The Hill from which I read earlier. It's called We Must Not Tolerate the Deaths of the Nation's Most Vulnerable. Keller is a professor of medical history and bioethics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Professor Keller, welcome to the 21st Show. Thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I want to begin our conversation by reading a text message we got from one of our listeners. And I should mention, we'll invite our listeners to join us a little later at 800-222-9455. But this is somebody named Kyle who said, it's exhausting feeling like the only one who still cares about my health and the health of my family and community. When I see people without masks in stores, all I see are walking tombstones. My six-week-old newborn still needs me to be careful for her sake and my sake. I wish other people in this community, state, and country felt the same way. Can you talk about this stage of the pandemic we're in and how it's unlike any other we've lived through in terms of government regulation, but also just this overall sentiment in the population and society?
Sure. I have to agree. I think it is utterly exhausting. I'm as sick of the pandemic and as sick of the precautions as anyone. Certainly not arguing for anything like a kind of forever masking approach or anything along those lines. I do think, however, we need to think about these kinds of metrics that we should be using to allow for relaxing precautions. As you said earlier, we're experiencing about twice the deaths, excess deaths due to COVID-19, as when the CDC first relaxed its recommendations on masking. Now, it strikes me that really it's kind of misguided to be setting aside basic precautions until things improve significantly. A metrics-based approach is, I think, sensible, and the metrics just aren't there right now.
And yet, I don't know what it's like in Madison, but certainly in central Illinois and the places I travel, I don't see a lot of people wearing masks, occasionally at various groups. What do you see in your community?
I think in Madison, there is a little bit more masking than we might see in other areas of the state. Mm-hmm. At the same time, really, people seem to have pretty much dropped precautions. I went to Walgreens to pick up a prescription this morning, and I was the only person in the pharmacy with a mask, including the pharmacists themselves. So I think people have gotten this message that we can relax these precautions, and they've taken it to heart, not even thinking about, you know, a pharmacy is technically a healthcare setting. You're going to have vulnerable people coming in and out. And really, it's not too difficult, I think, to wear a mask, at least when in the store.
So in your op-ed for The Hill, you write about something called excess deaths or excess mortality. This has been getting a lot of attention lately in how the idea being that the official death toll from COVID-19 may be a fairly significant undercount. Can you talk about how deaths are measured and how that's changed throughout the pandemic?
Sure. There are typically two ways to measure mortality. And this is in any case, you know, if you're looking at just sort of basic background mortality in the United States. We can attribute causes of death based on what's written on the death certificate. And that almost always is going to result in an undercount of whatever phenomenon we're talking about, whether it's heart disease or lung cancer or COVID-19, because really death certificates can be awfully incomplete. The other way we can measure mortality, and this works better if we're talking about like a disaster situation, say an extreme heat wave, an extreme cold snap, a pollution event, something along those lines, where we look at the start of the phenomenon, the end of the phenomenon, and we count how many people died. And then we subtract the amount of people who ordinarily we would have expected to die. Because really, day by day, year by year, the number of deaths on any given March 29th, any given March 28th, any given March 27th is remarkably consistent. And so what we do is we subtract that average death from the observed death, and that gives us this figure of excess deaths. And in the absence of any other major epidemic or any other major health event that's happening, that excess death toll, we can usually attribute to whatever it is we're trying to measure. Again, whether it's a disaster, whether it's a pandemic, whatever the phenomenon is we're trying to gauge.
Okay. We need to take a break. We're going to continue our conversation with Professor Richard Keller of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. His recent piece in The Hill is called We Must Not Tolerate the Deaths of the Nation's Most Vulnerable. 800-222-9455 if you want to join our conversation. Do stay with us. This is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking about this latest phase of COVID-19 in which the government and health authorities say most Americans no longer need to wear masks, even though the death toll continues to be a lot higher than it was, almost basically double what it was the last time the government said this. The CDC, when it relaxed the masking requirements last May for vaccinated Americans, 631 U.S. COVID deaths was the seven-day average, and it was basically double that this time around when it said most Americans no longer need to wear masks. We're talking about that and how, you know, this idea of moving on versus, you know, accommodating and thinking of the people who still cannot get vaccinated or don't have good immune responses. We're talking about this with Richard Keller, who wrote a piece in The Hill called We Must Not Tolerate the Deaths of the Nation's Most Vulnerable. He's professor of medical history and bioethics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. We want to know how you feel about the current state of COVID at 800-222-9455. Are you still wearing a mask in public? Are you nervous about new variants or subvariants? 800-222-9455. And more broadly, have we as a society become numb to death? Or is it time to move on? 800-222-9455 is the number to join our conversation. 800-222-9455. CDC officials and those charged with managing the pandemic have also begun to change the way they talk about the virus. And this is validated, I think, a lot of people who've sort of said, oh, this is just like the flu since, you know, the beginning, who've been a little more nonchalant about the effects of the pandemic. I want to play a clip from CDC Director Rochelle Walensky.
But, you know, when I think about what the years ahead look like, and I don't even mean the months ahead, I think that overall our immunity is going to hold us in good stead. I don't know whether we're going to need another boost, and I don't know when, and I don't know what that's going to look like. But I do think ultimately we will have good level population immunity for variants that come our way, and that even if surges come, the amplitudes of those surges will be less. And that ultimately we will have a coronavirus that will, you know, it will lead to death in some people every season. That we will then tolerate in some way.
And we will tolerate in some way that death, as we do with the flu, as we do with other things. Professor Keller, can you respond to that?
Sure. I think one of the reasons that I think the U.S. has grown to accept this level of mortality as somehow normal is a kind of trivialization of COVID-19. Really, since the start of the pandemic, we've heard that those who are at the highest risk of hospitalization and death are older Americans or those with underlying health conditions. And I think this leads to two really flawed assumptions. The first is that because deaths are happening in these populations, they somehow don't matter as much because these people may already have had one foot in the grave. But really, nothing could be further from the truth. A number of recent studies indicate that people who have died from COVID-19 in the US have died an average of between 8 and 14 years earlier than expected. And I think the second flawed assumption is that these deaths are only going to affect a small number of people. And that, I think, is the implication of what Rochelle Walensky is saying in that talk where you just played the clip. But I think it's important to recognize that 2/3 of Americans are overweight or obese. Nearly 15% are diabetic. About half of Americans have hypertension. 7% have coronary artery disease. 40% are going to be diagnosed with cancer at some point in their lifetimes. And 15% have chronic kidney disease. All of these conditions elevate risk for dying from COVID-19, and many Americans suffer from several of them at once.
Yeah,
and so that kind of vulnerability is more widespread than we imagine.
Yeah, and I mean, we got a text message along these ideas from Randy, who said, you're not seeing the real set of issues that are now called COVID. The reason is comorbid issues that are so very, very hard for all Americans, but in particular, populations in stress. Obesity and diabetes are perhaps the most hideous. They make COVID 20 times more deadly. Those are what are being denied real medical treatment. They're being called COVID because that is what kills. Cure obesity and the COVID death will go away. Can you talk about that? I mean, are we treating the right thing? I mean, there certainly have been efforts to address obesity and heart disease and all the other, you know, things that we now call comorbidities to COVID. But, you know, sort of, I guess it's the sort of chronic versus acute distinction, right?
Sure. I mean, I would argue that I think COVID is playing an absolutely critical role here. I think it's the catalyst that is really kind of surfacing these other pervasive health problems. It's important, I think, to recognize that for the past 20 years, 2/3 to 4/5 of all deaths in the United States have had multiple causes. So comorbidity is a basic fact of American life. And so rather than, I think, congratulating ourselves on eliminating deaths in other otherwise healthy populations, as many health officials and people like David Leonhardt in the New York Times and Emily Oster at The Atlantic are arguing, I think we should be absolutely aghast at the prevalence of comorbidity and be working to identify meaningful ways to reduce risk for people who are immune compromised, disabled, or who have other underlying health conditions, because really they're all around us.
Can you talk to that sentiment about the people who are, I think one of the phrases I've heard is vaxxed and done. You know, people who still, you know, have worn the mask, they've had their 2 or 3 shots, they followed social distancing protocols. And now at this point they say, you know, I'm tired of it. Maybe I've had mild COVID or whatever. I want to live my life normally. How do you respond to that sort of exhaustion out there? I mean, you talked about it yourself.
Sure. The phrase I've heard is vaxxed and relaxed. I can completely understand where people are coming from. I wish I could be so cavalier, I guess. But I think that basically we failed as a society in some ways to see the pandemic as a collective risk that demands collective solutions. Virtually everything the government's done to fight the disease places the burden on individuals to assess and mitigate their own risk according to their own risk tolerance. And that's where I think we're getting this sentiment, seeing this really widespread sentiment of, okay, I'm done. The implication, I think, is that people who are dying from the disease are dying as a result of their individual failings. And as a result, we see what I would argue is an enormous discounting of those deaths as deaths that somehow don't matter.
Interesting. Yeah. So say more about that, seeing death as a result of individual failings and deaths that don't matter. I mean, is there a track record of this in our society?
I think there is. There are certain kinds of deaths that we've come to accept as somehow inevitable. And I think COVID deaths are increasingly falling into that category. But we've seen this with the opioid epidemic. We've seen this with gun violence. Really, in nowhere else in the world do we see this kind of tolerance of gun violence. But in the United States, we send thoughts and prayers and seem to accept it as something we can't do anything about. I think we've seen the same thing toward deaths that are due to diabetes, higher rates of heart disease in rural communities and in communities of color in particular. Communities of color are really disproportionately affected by COVID mortality, but also by all of these other comorbidities. I think the CDC has rightly proclaimed that racism is a public health threat, just like economic inequality is a public health threat. But recommendations to relax COVID precautions in the face of what's still staggering mortality strike me as a real betrayal of those communities.
Okay, we are. Let me remind listeners, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Richard Keller, who's a professor of medical history and bioethics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, about this tension between this idea of vaxxed and relaxed or vaxxed and done on the one hand, and the government telling us that we no longer have to wear masks or take distancing precautions, and yet a significant share of our population, either by the fact that they are under 5 years old or immunocompromised or have multiple medical conditions that make them more vulnerable to COVID, are not in as safe a position as a sort of fit young person might be to fight off this disease. Let's go to the phones at 800-222-9455. Kay is calling in from Champaign. Kay, thank you for calling in.
Hi, thanks for having me. I hear repeatedly that when anybody in the media talks about relaxing mask mandates, that people are tired of it. And that seems to me to be just a ludicrous reason. You know, would you rather be tired or dead? There are so many people who still are able to catch this disease or can't develop the immunity that they need, and the rest of us need to think about that.
All right, so, Kay, thank you so much for calling in. I appreciate that. I want to read a couple of other texts from our listeners. One of them said, "In my opinion, politicians have decided to stop fighting COVID because they know there is little they can do to force people to get vaccinated, wear masks, and social distance. I, this person, attended an event at WILL, our home station, last week, and most of us wore masks and were seated 6 feet apart. Yet when I walk into a grocery store, it's like nothing at all is wrong." Another texter, Ryan, wrote, "For all Biden complained about COVID response on the campaign trail, did he do anything differently than Trump? It does feel like governments at all levels abandoned reason and gave in to the whining of a vocal minority," end quote. So, Professor Keller, on this topic of government officials and the way they've responded, a lot of people did think President Biden was going to be the answer to help address specifically some of the disparities about how maybe the pandemic affects places of poverty, communities of color, which were hit harder. Do you think that, can you compare life under this current administration? Are you surprised at all by their reaction and the course things have taken?
Sure. I should also be quite specific. I'm not a political scientist, so talking about politics is a little bit outside my lane. I do think the vaccine rollout in the spring of 2021 was truly exceptional. I mean, we saw it was difficult to get a vaccine for the first month or so, but almost immediately, really, anyone who is eligible was able to get a shot. And anyone who was able to get their second shot. And when boosters became available, I mean, this was a truly effective rollout. So I think that arguing that there's no distinction between the administrations is a little bit inaccurate. It's important, I think, to note that vaccination is an excellent form of prevention, but we're seeing a turn toward a vaccination-only strategy. And that's where I think the messaging is a bit flawed. This notion that we are living in a pandemic of the unvaccinated is really just not quite the case. There have been more than 50,000 deaths due to breakthrough infections in the past year. Brian, you mentioned earlier that there have been 4,000 in Illinois alone. This is about the same total mortality in a particularly bad flu year. Now, this isn't to say that vaccines aren't effective. I think quite the opposite. The evidence has shown that they're quite powerful. But there are certain people with underlying health conditions for whom vaccination just isn't as effective as it is for others. So we need to do more to protect those vulnerable populations, including making treatment widely available, practicing non-pharmaceutical interventions such as masking, social distancing, and frequent testing. But the problem is that Congress just denied funding for these practices, meaning that they're up to individuals who think they're worthwhile and who can afford to engage in them.
Yeah. And as we mentioned in our previous segment, community testing sites in Illinois are closing. It's potentially going to be a little more difficult to get a test. And as we are watching this BA2 subvariant growing in a number of countries overseas, I want to end, though, with a more sort of philosophical big picture point, which is you've written about how we memorialize death. And we only have a couple minutes left, but there are not great memorials to the 1918 to 1920-21 flu pandemic. And yet, you know, the death toll from COVID-19 is, what, 30 times what it was on 9/11? Do you think, are we going to sort of, will we as a society try to willfully forget this pandemic?
I'm afraid I think that's exactly what we're seeing happening, because these are deaths that are uncomfortable to think about, because they're rooted in economic inequality, they're rooted in racial inequality, they're rooted in the kinds of root causes that we as a society have proven time and again incapable of reflecting on. And so, well, there is certainly a move in Congress to make the first Monday in March an annual Memorial Day for those who've died from COVID-19. Unfortunately, I don't think it's getting traction, because these uncomfortable truths are things that we really don't seem to want to face as a society.
Richard Keller is a professor of medical history and bioethics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st Show.
Thanks so much for having me, Brian. It's been a great conversation.
Stay safe. And we will have a link to his piece in The Hill. It's called We Must Not Tolerate the Deaths of the Nation's Most Vulnerable. We'll have a link to that at our website, 21stshow.org. And that is all the time we have for our show today. The 21st is produced by Anna Casey, Aiden Choate, and Erica Scalise, who's also our engagement producer. Our interns are Owen Henderson, Zainab Qureshi, and Briel Skullark. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. At our website, I mentioned it a moment ago, 21stshow.org, you can also find a link to subscribe to our podcast. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and NPR One. Just search for The 21st. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.